Our first panelist is Austin King. Austin has served as the president of the Madison, Wisconsin City Council, an organizer with SEIU Local 150, and the national director of Acorn Financial Justice Center. Austin currently lives in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, and is pursuing a JD from NYU and an MPP from the Kennedy School. Please welcome Austin King.
I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and those of you not from Wisconsin may not know what an all-star cast we have. I get to play leadoff, and I'm going to try to set the stage for what's happening in Wisconsin. I wanted to set the stage in terms of the policy that has caused this response and this uproar in Madison, and I think you're going to hear a lot of different perspectives about what's happening on the ground and what it means for the broader progressive movement, but I wanted to lay the groundwork. This is the first time in my adult lifetime that we've had Republican uniform control of the Wisconsin government. They have the Assembly, the Senate, the governorship, and the Supreme Court currently on a 4-3 vote. My whole life we've had divided government in Wisconsin. We had Governor Tommy Thompson for 14 years, who later was Health and Human Services Secretary to Bush, who was a great friend of the state employee unions in Wisconsin. Then we had a Democrat, Governor Jim Doyle, who was no good friend of the state employees. He actually ran on a pledge to cut 10,000 state jobs. But we've had this rather schizophrenic politics in Wisconsin. We're a closely divided state, a purple state in many presidential elections. And I think what's happened in some respect is that this is the first time we've actually had the radical right fully empowered and without any checks and balances. And unlike the Democratic Party, which just controlled all three branches of government in Wisconsin the last 2 years, this Republican majority is actually intent on using its majority to achieve something like a Karl Rove vision of permanent power. They're also not your sort of standard fare Republicans. These are hardcore corporatists. One of the ways that I think about the Republican Party's roots in Wisconsin, it was, of course, born in Wisconsin in the 1850s as an abolitionist party, but it was always about local control in Wisconsin. And actually, in addition to the assault on public workers and collective bargaining, Governor Walker has unleashed a full-fledged assault on local control and the ability of local governments to make decisions. This is a very radical proposal and set of proposals. I'm sure many of you have heard about the collective bargaining rights being rescinded. This has already, unfortunately, been signed into law. This was the maybe the flashpoint that led to some of these uprisings and the spontaneous gatherings at the Capitol. But what's actually being proposed is even far more radical than just eliminating the 50-plus years of labor peace we've had in Wisconsin with collective bargaining rights for public employees. And so I wanted to tell you a little bit about what it is that Governor Scott Walker has proposed in the budget. I think the best summary I've heard of this budget was from a state rep from out west in La Crosse. She said, "This is not a Wisconsin that people will recognize." And it's true. Scott Walker's proposed an $834 million cut to K-12 education. That's about $750 per public school student in the state of Wisconsin. It's going to lead to about 5,000 teacher layoffs. He's proposed a $250 million cut to the University of Wisconsin higher education system, which is something that we treasure and something traditionally that both parties have treasured and fought to defend in the state of Wisconsin. He's also proposed privatizing our flagship school, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and spinning it off so that they can hike tuition and stop having so many in-state students come. He's proposed $147 million cuts to shared revenue to local government, which helps keep property taxes down. He's proposed a $72 million cut to technical colleges, a $53 million cut to corrections, a $505 million cut, $500 million in elimination of subsidies for health insurance and income support for low-income families, $284 million in cuts to programs that serve seniors and people with disabilities, $104 million in cuts to child care, $49 million is in cuts to transit. Basically, everything that makes the state work and that makes it great, he's proposed eliminating or cutting substantially to the bone. And he says he needs to do this because we are in deep financial straits. Like many other states around the country, we do have a budget deficit. But of course, this has become the pretext for assaults on workers, assaults on the poor, and assaults on our very way of life in Wisconsin. And of course, this is the playbook that Chris Christie is using in New Jersey, Governor Kasich is using in Ohio, and Governor Snyder in Michigan and all around the country. But of course, you know, he can find poverty in our state budget in order to attack the poor, but it's not so poor that he can't give away some money to his friends. So he's proposed a $400 million hike in road building. That's for new road construction. The road builders lobby is one of the most important Republican lobbies in the state of Wisconsin. Basically, they want to pave our entire state and turn everything into subdivisions where everyone has to listen to AM radio when they drive 40 miles to work. He's proposed a $115 million corporate tax break, which has already been signed into law. He's proposed a $36 million tax break for investors and a $49 million tax break for health savings accounts. He's also, while he's assaulting public education across the entire state, he's specifically assaulting what remains of public education in the city of Milwaukee, which was the original voucher experiment under former Governor Tommy Thompson. It was sold to the state as a way to assist low-income people in the city of Milwaukee, low-income students, get a better education. So they've got school choice, they can get some vouchers. He's proposed eliminating all the requirements that it be essentially for poor students in the city of Milwaukee and opening it up to parochial schools, to private schools, to the rich kids in the suburbs, so that they too can get a $6,000 check from the state of Wisconsin and taxpayers to pay for their private religious education. In essence, this is a full frontal assault on everything we hold dear. And only part of this has passed. The part that's passed is one of the most important parts, is the elimination of collective bargaining rights for public employees. And so I want to talk a little bit about what that means and what it's caused. So you'll hear a lot about the protests. I've only been to one of the big days of protests this last Saturday, March 12th, which over 100,000 people were there. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I was there with my stepmom, who's a guidance counselor in a public high school, and thinking about retiring because she doesn't have a contract, and the vested health insurance coverage she has might be taken away by her district under the authority that has been given to local school districts now to essentially eliminate health insurance and require pension givebacks from their workers. The protest was beautiful. It started with a tractor pull. You know, hundreds of farmers from all across the state came, and dozens of them brought their tractors and pulled them around the Capitol Square. One of the best things about what's happened is the incredible diversity of this coalition. It's students, it's workers, yes, it's public sector workers, and yes, they're the ones who maybe are most affected, but it's also people from all over the state. It's farmers, it's suburbanites. My parents live in the North Shore of Milwaukee, where there's an active recall effort against one of the Republican state senators, and I went to a budget hearing there. I've never seen a crowd of sleepy suburbanites so jazzed up as I did. That was this last Monday night. They're out for blood. They're doing a recall against this moderate, presumably pro-choice Republican state senator, and they have enthusiasm and energy like nothing I've ever seen. The other thing that's happened is that these attacks have really radicalized the people of Wisconsin, not just the sleepy suburbanites in the North Shore of Milwaukee, but even rank-and-file union members. It was a couple weeks before the Walker administration succeeded using a parliamentary trick in passing the collective bargaining repeal that the local AFL-CIO, the South Central Federation of Labor, nearly unanimously endorsed a call for a general strike should the legislation pass. And there's a flyer right there with the wildcat from the IWW. This was a very popular flyer at the rally on Saturday. General strike is a watchword that's on the lips of nearly, I'd say, probably half the crowds that are in Madison. It's a really radical concept, but one that's gained mainstream traction because of these unprecedented attacks. It's very exciting, and it's really quite beautiful. Part of the reason that this was able to happen is that we had 14 state senators who were Democrats who fled the state. Now, the Democratic Party, like I said, has been a little bit schizophrenic with organized labor. Governor Doyle was no friend of workers. Actually, one of the worst Democrats in the state Senate, Jeff Plaley, was beaten in a primary last fall by a young progressive named Chris Larson, and then turned around and voted against ratifying the state contracts for state workers, leaving some 100,000 state workers in a lurch without a contract. So it was a Democratic Senate, when we had uniform Democratic control of government, that refused to ratify contracts. And that's why we're in the position we're in with all these vulnerable state workers. Anyway, Jeff Plaley, the state senator who voted against ratifying the contracts, then took a cushy job with the Scott Walker administration, where he's making a lot of money and not really worried about his future. So this has caused, obviously, an enormous backlash, an enormous protest, a beautiful movement. You know, I get weepy when I think about the Green Bay Packers winning the Super Bowl, but I get especially moved by these incredible, beautiful demonstrations of solidarity, of democracy. You know, the entire city of Madison is honking. This is what democracy looks like. And really, that's actually happening all across the state. There are small rallies in towns like Washburn, Wisconsin, with 2,000 people showing up. I mean, it's really hard to get 2,000 people to a rally in Madison or Milwaukee, let alone Washburn. And even when the Republican state senators went to D.C. this week, they found thousands of people in Washington, D.C. protesting against them when they were at a big fundraiser. And I don't know if anyone's seen something like this in their lifetimes. I'm pretty young, but I've been in politics for about a decade in organizing work and labor, and I've never seen anything this beautiful, except maybe the Packers winning the Super Bowl twice in my lifetime. And And so there are a couple big responses that are happening right now. There's sort of the movements in Madison have in many senses spread out to the communities. There are a lot of rallies happening around the state. It's not about these huge demonstrations, although there was a big one yesterday on the Capitol Square. There are active recall efforts against 8 Republican state senators. You can't recall the governor for a full year because he was just elected, but there inevitably will be a recall effort against Governor Walker. The recall efforts against the state senators have gained a lot of steam and a lot of energy and a lot of money from around the country. More than $2 million has flowed into Wisconsin in an effort to recall these folks. There's litigation against the legislation. Just this week, a Dane County judge, Marianne Sumi, issued a temporary restraining order enjoining the legislation from taking effect until they can rule on a series of allegations that it violated open meetings laws, the conference committee between the Senate and Assembly did when they passed this, basically under the cover of night and without any public notice. It's very obviously clear that they broke the open meetings law. The other anti-democratic efforts that have come out of the Capitol are incredible. They shut down the Capitol, the People's House. These beautiful demonstrations that were in the rotunda and people sleeping over basically scared the bejesus out of the Walker administration. And so they did things that, I mean, we didn't, not after 9/11 did we have as much security as we have had this last week because of all these scary teachers and nurses angry and protesting. It's quite absurd. I mean, I had to wait about 45 minutes just to get into the Capitol. State representatives were unable to get into the Capitol to vote on this bill. It's been an incredible shutdown and affront to democracy, and the Walker administration has been found to have violated the Wisconsin Constitution in doing that, also by a Dane County judge. How am I doing on time? I'm about to wrap up. So there's a lot going on. It's a really exciting time. And hopefully it's a little infectious, too. I know we've seen growing solidarity rallies. There was one in New York a few weeks ago that had maybe 10,000 people at it. There have been huge rallies in Lansing, in Columbus, in Indianapolis, in Trenton. And hopefully this keeps building. I'm not going to go too far afield into what this means for everyone, but to me it means the world. And to my family it probably means our house. If we lose this fight and we lose our health insurance, we're probably going to lose our house, and that's true for tens of thousands of people in Wisconsin. This is a real serious fight, and that's why people are so mobilized. And I really want to thank you all for coming here today and standing with us in solidarity.
Thank you, Austin. Our next speaker is Sarah Mansky. Sarah is a journalist, and she's a founder of PolicyPair.com and a Wisconsin Wave organizer. Please welcome Sarah.
Hello, everyone. I'm really excited to be here to talk about something I love, and that's the great state of Wisconsin, my home state. The people of Wisconsin really love their state, and I just want to add a couple things to the great summary that Austin did. In addition to collective bargaining, the Graduate Student Employees Union, the TAA, the people who grade the papers and teach a bunch of students, right? Their union will no longer even be recognized by the state of Wisconsin. Yeah, and also the UW Hospital Nurses Union would no longer be recognized by the state of Wisconsin. And Walker thought that he could break off the firefighters and the police union by exempting them from this bill, right? And the great thing about the firefighters was they came out and said, no way, we're not going to be broken off. We're going to stand with all the other workers and the students and the people of color. Yeah. So my job here today is to give you a little bit of the who, what, when, where of what happened, because it's a lot of stuff happened, and I'm just going to go over the highlights. But there are a couple things to keep in mind while I do this. So starting in the summer, there was this message that Wisconsin's in crisis and we're facing a severe budget deficit. And so people were hearing that. But one of the kind of nice things that happened was Ben Mansky here decided to run for state assembly with the Green Party in Madison, Wisconsin. And so, as most politicians do, you know, you meet with editorial boards and union leaders and high school students, and, you know, they asked him, why should we endorse you? Because we're facing a big budget deficit. How are you going to get all these progressive things accomplished? And Ben would tell them, look, we need to tax the rich, We need to raise taxes on the highest tax income, the highest tax bracket, right? And so they have been hearing this message since the summer. And we put out radio ads and television commercials and flyers, and we had hundreds of volunteers going door to door. And people, the first thing they asked us, we have a budget deficit, what should we do? And we're like, we should tax the rich. And the funny thing is, you know, as a third-party candidate, Ben got more votes than any other third-party candidate in the state of Wisconsin since the 1940s. And the wealthiest parts of Ben's district actually voted for his policy of taxing the rich. So people had been hearing this, so they were prepared, right, for this message from Governor Walker that we were facing a big budget deficit. Okay, students, in addition to what they do every year, were also organizing at UW-Madison and Milwaukee to fight the impending tuition increase that they knew was coming, and also the increasing privatization that's been happening over the past 15 years. And so the students had been organizing a Valentine's Day protest, and they knew that Governor Walker was going to try to, you know, cut funding for the university. They didn't quite realize it was going to be this much. But this protest for Valentine's Day had been planned weeks before. And so Valentine's Day was on the 14th of February. And that Friday before, the governor came out and told the public about his plan to cut collective bargaining. And of course, the entire state just took one giant, like, you're going to do what? So a protest, he also put the National Guard on notice, by the way. So I think he knew he had some idea that people wouldn't take this sitting down. Anyway, so a rally of UW-Madison students, it was supposed to be, you know, a couple hundred, turned out to be a couple thousand that Monday. And people went to the governor's office with Valentines that said, you know, Governor Walker, don't break my heart, don't cut the university, don't privatize it, and dumped all these Valentines right in front of his office, thousands of them. The next day, thousands of unionists and students and, you know, all the people of Wisconsin who had been organizing around progressive issues showed up at the state capitol and packed it. It was wall to wall, and our Capitol building is huge on the inside, and so you can imagine how many people were in there. The way the occupation started was that the Democrats had been holding public hearings, and, you know, hundreds of people signed up to testify against this bill, and the hearing that would normally end after a couple hours just kept going and going and going, and I think it went on for 85 hours straight. And so it went all night long, and people just never left. And then people said, hey, we need some food, and we should go get our sleeping bag. And so they decided to occupy the state capitol. And that's kind of how the occupation started and then lasted for weeks after that. In addition, that day, on that Tuesday, the Green Bay Packers came out. Several of the players came out in support, and Tammy Baldwin came out in support. And we start hearing these rumors about how people are doing rallies around the country in support of Wisconsin. So the hearings continue all night. And then Wednesday, the public school teachers do a sick out. They decide, no classes. And they all show up at the state capitol. And so people hear, okay, that the hearings are going to end. And Thursday, the 17th, the state Senate is going to vote on this bill, and because the Republicans were in the majority, we figured, okay, it's going to pass. So the Capitol is packed with people, wall to wall, and people start hearing that the Democratic senators aren't going to go to the floor. They're going to deny quorum, and so people start packing in front of the doors of all the senators, and I was in front of Chris Larson's door. And, you know, the police would try to come down the stairs, and people were like, no. And everybody was really ready to get arrested to try to stop the senators from being compelled to go to the floor, right? And that was the day that they all left and went to Illinois. And it felt like a great big victory that these senators looked out the window, and they're not all great Democrats. Like, some are really good, but some are kind of corporate Democrats, right? But they all looked out the window and said, wow, we have to stand with the people of Wisconsin. There are thousands of people out here. We can't do this. So they did something pretty radical, and I count that as a victory for the people of the state of Wisconsin, that they actually did that. Also, something that was really exciting that happened on Thursday was the police union decided to show up and bring snacks and water for the crowd. We're like, we knew the firefighters were with us, but then when the police union is with us too, then we start seeing these signs that say cops for labor. And we're like, really? The police are in here too? Wow, we really are going to win, right? So that was great. Jesse Jackson, oh, also on Thursday, another teacher sick out, right? There's no public school again on Thursday. And then on Friday, another teacher sick out, right? So 3 days in a row, the public school teachers called in sick and said showed up at the Capitol instead. So that was pretty exciting. So Jesse Jackson arrives on Friday. There are student walkouts all over, high school, UW, all over the state. In addition to what's happening in Madison, as Austin mentioned, there's little mini direct action stuff happening all over the state of Wisconsin. And if you've never been to Wisconsin, it's a fairly rural state. Like, many cities are a couple hundred to maybe a few thousand people. So Saturday, huge rally, you know, 50 to 80,000 people show up in the state, right on the Capitol. The Tea Party decides they're going to have a counter rally. And they come out, and they have this very sad little 2,000-person rally that they had to bus people in for, right? And so, you know, that was also encouraging because you look around and you realize there isn't a lot of homegrown support for this cuts to public services. Okay, so Sunday, the police decide, we hear rumors that they're going to arrest everybody in the state capitol. You know, things happen. The police come in at 2 in the morning and they tear everybody's posters down. But that doesn't happen. Okay. So people are energized. On that Monday, the South Central Federation of Labor, our kind of umbrella group for all the labor unions, calls for a general strike. And not only a general strike in Madison, but in the entire country, calls on all labor unions to go on strike, both public and private. And that was pretty unprecedented for them to do that. So the Wisconsin Wave wants to move this beyond just a collective bargaining fight and move it towards looking at the people in the state of Wisconsin, our own Chamber of Commerce, or Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, who are really funding this. So we hold a picket of their conference, and we had several thousand unionists show up, which was really fun. I'm not going to get into all the nitty-gritty, but I want you to know that there have been, you know, obviously rallies of over 100,000. The temporary restraining order was issued. There was legal fights about, you know, how this bill was passed. Obviously, it was done illegally with only 2 hours' notice when they're supposed to give 24 hours. And we can get into more of that. But where do we go from now? Okay, the Wisconsin Wave is holding the first of a series of Wisconsin People's Assemblies, where we're going to have all the players come together in a forum like this to talk about what do we want to do now. Maybe we want to have our own budget. Maybe we want to organize something different in the state of Wisconsin so this never happens again, in addition to all the recall efforts that are going on. And I want to leave you with this. This is our slogan. It was in the rotunda. So everybody could see it. It said, "We are Wisconsin. We will win." Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. We've had two speakers, and I already feel like I'm in Wisconsin. You know, where I feel like you, instead of bringing Wisconsin here, you brought us all there. Our next speaker is going to be Monica Adams. Monica is a black, gay, working class, gender nonconforming woman, a community organizer, a scientist, and an activist scholar who brings a critical perspective to the fight in Madison, Wisconsin. Her work is based on centering the leadership of those most affected, specifically the black community, Southeast Asian community, queer people of color community, and other low-income communities of color. Her work strives to build an alternative society as the means to end our oppressions instead of reforming the current system. Monica Adams.
I just want to draw your attention to the pictures that are up there. Those came from Freedom Inc., which is a group that I organize with. And yesterday, Saturday, they organized an all people of color rally to go to the Capitol and elevate the issues and the ways in which the communities will be targeted. So I think we all have a pretty good idea in terms of what has been happening in Wisconsin. So I'm not going to spend much time on that today or much time talking about Scott's bill specifically. But I am going to spend more time talking about what are the next steps and what do we have to do in order to build a movement. So it's clear that everyone essentially in Wisconsin is opposed to the bill. But what is not so clear is what exactly are we for? And I mean this in a larger scale outside of the context of the specific bill. So what exactly will bring hundreds of thousands of people together again? Will it be to protect free lunch? Will it be to protect reduced lunch? Will it be to save food share, or will it be to save Badger Care? In this sense, there's a clear lack of political unity. It's very clear, once again, that we all are against the bill. It's very clear that we collectively shout, kill the bill. But what's not clear is, what is the alternative? Is the vision to simply go back to the way things were a year ago? Or is the vision something larger or something greater? And I think this is a critical question that we have to grapple with. Kwame Ture, also known to folks as Stokely Carmichael, brings up an interesting point in thinking about how we go about building movements, or what are people calling movements or movement efforts. And he says that there's a huge or significant difference between mobilizing and organizing. He says that mobilization or mobilizing is when a group of people are against the same thing. And he says that organizing is when a group of people are for the same thing. So while we've been very proud of the work that we've been doing in Madison, in fact, it was a huge mobilization effort and not so much a strong organization effort. And I think we need to spend more time figuring this out. And if we're all trying to build a vision or to figure out what exactly it is that we're for, we know that our work has to go beyond the sectors in which we participate. So what's happening inside of Wisconsin right now can no longer just be talked about as what's affecting public sector workers. It can no longer be talked about as just a movement of unions. It can no longer be talked about as groups of people, as firefighters or cops or teachers. Instead, we have to understand the response of what is happening in Wisconsin as part of a larger movement that strives for racial justice, that strives for gender justice, queer liberation, as well as dismantling ableism and other larger forms of oppression. And in my experience of being in Madison, or I'm located in Madison, in my experience in doing the work in Wisconsin, it has been incredibly inspiring to be part of a large group of people who are out mobilizing to achieve something. But at the same time, it also has been deeply troubling. And the harsh truth of the matter is, a lot of the folks who are out there, a lot of the workers who are out there mobilizing against Walker are the very people that had put him in office to begin with. And I think it's important to understand this, because this is going to determine how we build a solid base in order to build a movement. A lot of the people who voted for Walker initially did so because they believed an all too typical, all too common narrative of lazy workers, thinking that it was just a targeted attack on people of color and immigrant folks, when in actuality he was talking about all of us. Surprise, right? And so while we are out supporting worker rights, people of color, immigrant folks, And while we're out fighting the fight, occupying space alongside it in solidarity, we have to ask the critical questions: will this same group of people turn out and support us and our issues? So I'll give you an example of this. So in the bill, there's a piece of legislation that says that healthcare insurance providers would no longer be required to pay for contraceptives for women, but they would still be required, or they would still pay for Viagra. Right? And instead of thinking of this as just some small piece of legislation or something peripheral to the larger fight of collective bargaining, we must view this as a fundamental attack on women's reproductive health rights. So I think all of these points that I'm bringing up are part of a larger question of what is our collective vision. Once again, is it just to get things back the way they were a year ago, which were not so good for many communities, my community specifically, or is it to build the world that we want to live in? But I think to really be able to address that question or to answer some of those challenging questions, we also have to grapple with the idea of what is the collective identity. So what's central in movements is that people have a common sense or identify around something. And it cannot, once again, it cannot just be mobilization. It cannot be we all disagree on this. That's merely a coalition. If we're talking about a movement, we all have to collectively strive for something and be able to identify with each other on some sort of level. So the question is, who is the we? Who is the we of Wisconsin? Is the we just the workers? Is the we just the middle class public sector? Is it just the police officers, the firefighters, and the teachers? Or is it also the undocumented migrant workers who make up a significant part of the dairy industry? Or is it the chronically unemployed? Is it the chronically underemployed? Is it those of us who never get fair chances at meaningful job opportunities due to structural racism, classism, cisgenderism, et cetera? Who is the collective we? Also, is the playing field to be able to participate in this movement leveled? For example, what do the leadership spaces look like? Frankly, I've been in too many spaces where all the faces look the same. I've been in too many important decision-making opportunities where all of the people look the same. If we are building a movement of the people and for the people, where the hell are all the people? Right? We have to be able to ask those very tough questions. And I think what's unique about this opportunity here is now we are forcing an allyship of folks who are not traditional allies. And I think this could be something incredibly good, but we have to be able to do the hard work of ensuring that it turns out to be something incredibly good and not give Scott Walker, Republicans, and Tea Parties the opportunity to play into some of this stuff and play onto divide and conquer antics. And I also in that mind frame or in that spirit, I think, you know, we've been doing a lot of assuming around us having the common enemy and therefore necessitating that to mean that we are friends. And I think we see on a lot of different levels that that's not necessarily true. So in that same question, if we're talking about building a collective identity or struggling to build that, the question then becomes, How deep is the allyship? Is it really solidarity? And a question that I ask all of you in this room and as well as the greater society is, what happens if we win collective bargaining? What happens if he comes up tomorrow and says, okay, damn it, I'm tired. You won. What if he says, I'll leave the rights of collective bargaining alone? Do we all go home then? Or do we say, no, we're going to knock this Capitol down if you don't give us back Badger Care? Right? And also in thinking about identities of folks, I think we also have to translate into what types of strategies do we take up to further the movement. As I mentioned, all of us do not have the same identities. So all of us can't equally participate in the same strategies. For example, I ask you, do you honestly think 150,000 black people can occupy the Capitol for 16 days? Right? I think, you know, I think we have the ability to do the mobilization ability to do it. But will we be there in solidarity with the police? Absolutely not. They will not. So this means that we have to think about building inclusive strategies. I also think that it took an incredible amount of privilege to be able to be there. I was there for a few days, but I also had the privilege to be able to be there. I didn't have children. Folks who I knew who wanted to come but had children could not do so. I lived in Madison. I had transportation. Like all of these other things, if we're talking about building a movement for the people, we have to create entry points so that all people can participate in all of the work that we are doing. And I think it kind of in that same spirit, we also have to do the very hard work of base building, but for coming from a place of solidarity, which means that we have to have ongoing political education around not just what does it mean to be a Republican, what does it mean to be a Democrat, or how does the mayor's office run, so to speak, but around what has been the struggles of folks of color in this country. How does hundreds of years of oppression tied to current policies. We have to be doing that ongoing mass political education around all of these things to build true relationships, which are going to be critical in developing movements. As well as doing political education, we need to get back to training folks in grassroots training. I think it's very attractive and very easy in ways to be able to engage us in some of this kind of academic work or very high policy work, but what about the everyday ability to knock on doors and to get people out who have no idea that this is going on? And also with that, I think we need to be thinking about escalating strategies, which we're beginning to see more of, and so we need to be training folks around direct action organizing, right? So not only are we going to peacefully protest, right, we're still going to be nonviolent, but we're going to turn up the fire. Yes, we're going to shut down M&I Bank, but we're going to do more things. Because it's very clear that the right, Walker and other folks, Tea Party folks, have a very escalating strategy. And not only do we need to match it, but we need to be able to defeat it, which requires for us to be scientific and develop an escalating strategy. As well, thank you. As well as thinking about an escalating strategy, we also need to build strategies that feel relevant for people and people's everyday lives. Marches and protests feel very attractive, but I would even say that we should use people's skills and maybe put them in more relevant areas. Just a suggestion. For example, absolutely, teachers, if you want to strike. I'm not against a strike at all. But I also think teachers are in a unique position to be able to mobilize an entire youth body by using their youth teaching skills to educate and politicize the youth. And we know all social movements need the young folks, right? And there are more schools than just UW-Madison. I also think that we need to think about the ways that people live their daily lives. Am I over time? Oh, my God. Sorry. I'm going to be quick. I also think we need to think about the way that people live their everyday lives and how that can be politicized and connected to a larger movement, because I think there's a lot of wisdom in the resistance that folks carry every day. So I really want to elevate the narrative of the infra-political and be able to connect that to a larger structure. Struggle. Lastly, I'm going to emphasize that we start to think and build alternatives. I question any structure, any government that is able to take away so many rights so quickly. How does that happen? We cannot. We should not be able to support a structure. My rights should not be determined by whether or not this person is hopefully a good person in this office. We should begin to question those types of structure. We should also begin to invest in grassroots structures and folks building alternative societies who have been doing it all along. And because I'm over time, I'm going to wrap it up. As written on the Badger Care Card, as the state motto goes, as the movement demands, and as my good friend Max Rameau says, forward.
Wow. Thank you, Monica. That was amazing. I feel Monica laid out questions that each of us needs to answer for a lot of movements, not just in Wisconsin. Our next speaker needs little introduction, John Nichols. I'm sure many of you feel, as I do, that this is the voice that we kind of listen to on the airwaves to really get the daily updates on what was going on in Wisconsin. And thank you, John, for that tremendous reporting. John is a pioneering political blogger. He's written The Beat since 1999 for The Nation magazine as its Washington correspondent. He's a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, and dozens of other papers. He's also the author of The S Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism, as well as many other books. John Nichols.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm going to call immediately on my friend Molly Stentz. Where's Molly? Where are you? Come on down here, Molly. Come on down. Come on. I want you to, as she comes on, I'm going to give her a duty here. But will you give a huge round of applause to the news director for our community radio station in Madison, Wisconsin, Molly Stentz. Hey.
Come here.
Molly. Because everybody who wants to talk about this struggle over talks, including myself, I'm sure, my phone is going to ring in a few minutes. And I'm going to give you my phone, and you're going to answer it, and you're going to talk to the person on the other end and tell them you're the head of the community radio station, you're filling in with me until, and you're going to do a great job, okay? But before you do that, can you just shout it out and tell it? Give us 1 minute of what Wart's been doing, because it's, come on up here, come and stand by me for 1 sec. I apologize, I'm hijacking. I'm so sorry. But if you don't know the role of community radio in this struggle, you're missing out on a lot. So please welcome Molly Stentz.
Hi. Well, I think tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people really felt the importance of independent media at a time like this. I work for a radio station, WORT. We're independent, grassroots, non-commercial media, non-profit media. And my plane landed, I was covering the World Social Forum in Senegal, actually, and my plane landed on the 14th as I came back from the World Social Forum and found, you know, that my state was in crisis, and that our station is a mere few blocks away from the Capitol. We've been there in Madison broadcasting for 35 years, but as many people said, the station was really built for a time like this. I got back on the 14th, which was Valentine's Day, the day the Valentines were delivered by the graduate students, by the TAA, and we started our coverage nonstop every day on our local evening newscast. We have a daily talk show that we started booking guests on. We have a morning show. We had a lot of our music DJs interrupt their programming with breaking news, and people flocked to the station. People were calling. The phone was ringing off the hook, and then other stations started calling us around the country. A lot of the Pacifica stations, some independent stations, producers started coming and broadcasting out of our studios. We had Laura Flanders and Grit TV. We had Democracy Now. We had a lot of independent producers. We had the BBC calling us, wanting to know what was happening. And people really, as they started to look at the print coverage, they started to look at you know, some of the mainstream media, and realizing that it didn't cut it. You know, they were living it. You know, it's one thing to look at a story where you don't know any better whether the coverage is slanted or whether it just leaves, you know, glaring omissions out. But when you're living the story, when you're waking up and looking at the Capitol and looking at right outside your window, you know, the tens of thousands of people that are protesting, and you're realizing that they're not union thugs, and you know, there aren't palm trees in Wisconsin, and all of those things.
You know, as
people were joking. In Wisconsin, Fox News ran pictures of protests, you know, violent protests. And, you know, they didn't say it explicitly. It wasn't so bold as to say, you know, these are the people causing violent protests, but they just talked about it, and then they showed footage, and they showed people, you know, pushing and shoving, and, you know, it kind of led you to leap to the conclusion that, you know, oh, this was, you know, this is this angry mob, which is this meme that they've put out, you know, since day one and continues now in the courtroom battles. You have the department testifying that, you know, their security was compromised and they had to do these measures, you know, unprecedented measures to lock down the Capitol because their security was at stake and our legislators, they were being threatened and death threats and all of this stuff. So this is the meme that they're putting out there constantly every day to justify the behavior, this unprecedented behavior. But in this footage that from Fox News that people pointed out, you know, there were palm trees in the background, right? It was actually Southern California, you know, some totally unrelated demonstration that they dug up to show the picture that they wanted to convey, which is this angry mob idea. So people really saw that. A lot of people that were flipping through the channels or, you know, reading the daily newspaper and realizing that there was something really significant going on in the media and that independent media, grassroots producers, were providing a very real picture, a very real and accurate picture of what was happening daily on the ground. And so I think it was a huge, huge lesson for people in Wisconsin and hopefully elsewhere as to the essential nature of independent media. So I was just happy to be a small part of that, and glad that we had the infrastructure. So,
Holly, phone's gonna ring, and yeah, it's got a lock. You just push it up, and
okay.
Call
the governor. You're gonna talk
to us. Okay.
All right. Molly Stentz, a great, great local news director and producer. And you can go back toward the end or wherever, and I'll come find you. I got phone calls coming in. It's crazy stuff. I do apologize for the madness of what we do. But for the last month of my life, I have gotten up at about 4:30 or 5 in the morning, and I have gone till about 11, 12, sometimes 1, 2 in the morning. And I have done it for a very simple reason. I am a Wisconsinite. A seventh-generation Wisconsinite, and my state is under attack. And I am not going to sleep until we beat Scott Walker, until we beat the people behind him, until we beat a neoliberal agenda that would shut down our public services, lay off our public workers, lay off our teachers, and destroy our civil society. I will not let it happen. So, let me tell you what I've seen in Wisconsin. Well, among other things, I have seen the best posters ever. Period, bar none. I knew it was going good on the first big day of protests. This was the first Tuesday. There were about 8,000 to 10,000 people. And a guy standing in the crowd, an older guy who was a retired state employee, had a sign in Arabic. And I said, well, I've covered a lot in the Middle East, but I've never read, I don't know how to read that. And he said, oh, it says, Scott Walker stepped down like Mubarak did. And I thought, well, this is going to be very, very good. And it was only trumped a couple days later on a very, very cold day, a little bit close to zero temperature, where I saw someone walking with a big sign that said, I thought Cairo would be warmer. And the truth of the matter is, the humor, the energy, the great spirit of Wisconsinites has come through throughout this demonstration. And it is important to understand that what's worked in Wisconsin and what can work other places is an ability to learn from not just American traditions, not just Wisconsin traditions, but from the world. The fact of the matter is, yes, from the world. The fact of the matter is, what has worked in Wisconsin, a month of mass mobilization, massive demonstrations, would not have occurred if Cairo had not have occurred before. That is a fundamental reality. I heard it from the start. We didn't have to explain to anyone. When they came the first day and the second day and the third day, you know, those of us who cover politics, who are, you know, we're too punditocracized to be able to think anymore. We just assume, well, someday they're going to stop coming. And I would say to people, well, you know, what's up? What's kind of your timeline here? And they'd say, 18 days. That's how long they stayed out in Cairo. And it was 18 days was an underpinning of every single early protest. Nobody thought, oh, we're going to mobilize for a march on Washington, take the bus down, have a demonstration, count the people, and leave. No, they thought we're going to mobilize, come down, count the people, and then we're going to go home, sleep a little, and come back the next morning. And that's the power. That's the power. And I want to tell you something else. This is something, if you're there, you get it. If you're not, it's harder, because we don't have a media in this country that covers politics and labor and working people and poor people. We have a media in this country that only pays attention to poor people and working people when they get in the way of rich people. And the fact of the matter is, what happened in Wisconsin is poor people and rich people got in the way of poor people and working people got in the way of rich people every day, day after day. And the media started to pay a little bit of attention, but they didn't see the beauty of this thing. I want to pay homage to the people who didn't know they couldn't do it, right? The people who didn't know this was impossible. And I begin with the TAA, the Teaching Assistants Association at the University of Wisconsin. I was out, you know, I move in many circles, and I was out for dinner with a Democratic state legislator, very progressive guy, one of the most progressive guys in the legislature, a Democrat who supported Green Ben Manske for the state legislature. So this guy's not, you know, he's not in the mainstream of his party. And I'm out there being the pundit that I am. And it was the day after this had come down. And I said, Mark, what's going to happen here? And he said, oh, I was over at the union offices. They're in shock. Their jaws hanging down. And I said, what's happening in the Capitol? What's the response of the Democratic politicians in the Capitol? Well, they're in shock. Their jaws hanging down. They have no idea what to do, how to respond to such a blatant seizure of power, an attempt to destroy public sector unions, which is to destroy any sort of progressive politics in Wisconsin. And the public sector unions weren't all that progressive. But at least they would stand up and say, we need schools, we need snowplow drivers, we need social services. That was their radical act. This effort by the governor was going to destroy them, and everybody was like, I don't know what to do. I have no idea what to do. There's not another election for 4 years. We're going to have to wait. I mean, we just have to hold our breath for 4 years. Hope that, you know, we can survive. The next morning, 50 members of the TAA who hadn't been told what they couldn't do went and stood in front of the University of Wisconsin Memorial Union with signs that said, "This shall not pass. We oppose this bill, and we're going to organize against it and march against it and rally against it." 50 students. That's where it started. And then a few days later, 1,000. And then a day later, 10,000. And then a day later, people who didn't know what they couldn't do. The teachers walking out. I went up to one of the rallies on the day that the teachers walked out, and I thought, well, this is going to be bigger. This could be very interesting. And my car slowed down. I couldn't get up the street. There was something blocking the street. 10 in the morning, the teachers had walked out, yes. But now, walking up the main thoroughfare, East Washington Avenue, was 2,000 of their students walking 3 miles from their school to the Capitol to stand with their teachers. And when I got to the Capitol, 2,000 students came from the west side, and then 5,000 University of Wisconsin students, all dressed in red and white, the colors of our school, coming to the university, from the University of Wisconsin to the Capitol to speak truth to power. It was epic, it was beautiful, and it didn't stop. And it was because so many of us, and I know not the people in this room, but I tell you this story because you need to take it back You need to take it out to the people that you're wrestling with and debating with on these issues. The founders of this republic were imperfect men. There is simply no doubt of that. But the one good thing about them, the one fundamental thing about them is they formed this republic in revolution against a monarchy. They were against an empire that forced its control from afar on them. And so when they wrote the Constitution of the United States, they did not mention corporations. They did not mention how we elect our officials. They didn't outline how you elect local, state, county, municipal elected officials, how you elect governors. They didn't do that. They knew that power would figure out how to organize society to its advantage. And so the best of our founders in that First Amendment simply outlined what we ought to do to hold them to account. And they didn't say wait till the next election. What they said was, you have freedom of speech, a right to speak. And they weren't talking about what did you do last night. They weren't even talking about a right to swear, although I have nothing against swearing. They were talking about a right to speak truth to power, to challenge power. And they outlined freedom of the press. They weren't talking about the stenography to power that we see in so much of our mainstream media today. They were talking about a freedom to challenge power with a reporting and with an aggressive, broadly published, Tom Paine-influenced demand that power bend to the people. And then, the best thing of all, the right to assemble. And I got to tell you, man, that is the most under-respected right in the Constitution of the United States. The right to assemble. The right to put thousands of people in the street to say no. And that's what happened in Wisconsin. They used their right to assemble to petition for the redress of grievances. They did it outside the Capitol, and then they went inside the Capitol. They filled that building. I don't know if you have ever been with 10,000 people in a building, all of them chanting, an injury to one is an injury to all. But I will tell you, no politician can miss that sound. And when those Democratic legislators walked out, they were not, as Sarah so well illustrated, they were not the paragons of progressive virtue. They walked out because they did hear that sound. And this is the one thing I will tell you to take away from Wisconsin. We have great debates. How much do we do electoral? How much do we do the street? How much do we do, you know, organizing versus mobilization? All legitimate questions, valid questions. But at that core, when we organize or mobilize, what we must recognize is our power is physical. Our power is in the great mass of us to come together, no matter who is in that office, who is in that station of public power, and to say no. And that's what has to come from Wisconsin. A new vision in every state that when they come for our rights, we do not wait for the next election. We do what I saw Wisconsinites do. And then in the night they were trying to pass that bill, people grabbed their babies and ran from their homes. Drivers pulled their cars up on the curb and they ran to the capital of their state. And they ran into that capital shouting, shame, shame, shame. They filled that capital. And they did so in the very best of American radical traditions and the very best of international radical traditions. They put people power against political power. They did not wait for the next election. They did not wait for the next day. They put themselves in the streets. And when we do that in Wisconsin, in Indiana, in Michigan, in Ohio, and across this country, we will stop the assault on public employees. We will stop the assault on our teachers. We will stop the assault on our public sector workers and our private sector workers. And we will begin to frame out what our previous speaker so well outlined, a new vision of the American experiment that does not make apologies for saying that there can be no political democracy until there is economic democracy. Thank you very much.
Well, we've actually already heard about our next speaker from two of the previous speakers. Ben Mansky is a Wisconsin attorney and pro-democracy advocate. He's the executive director of Liberty Tree, a national strategy center dedicated to building a democracy movement for the USA. He also is a member of the executive committee of Move to Amend, co-founder of the Green Business Network, PosiPair.com, past co-chair of the Green Party of the U.S., a member of the sociology faculty at Madison College, and an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies. And it bears repeating, as Sarah mentioned earlier, Ben also ran for the state assembly as a Green, and he had the highest showing for a third-party candidate since 1944. Ben Mansky.
How are you all feeling right now? Pretty good. So I want to start off with six demands. Just give you a sense of where some of us here are coming from. First of all, we demand that our state government, the state of Wisconsin, must fully guarantee a fully funded public sector, including education, health care, human services, transportation, public safety, and vital regulatory agencies. We demand taxes on large corporations and wealthy individuals that they should be returned to a reasonable level, like when I was born, 1974. We demand that the state respect the rights of workers to organize and bargain collectively. We demand that the initial budget priorities, before anything gets written up on paper, must be established through public participation instead of through closed-door meetings between public officials and special interest lobbyists. We demand the expansion of voting rights. They should not be limited. We've got to expand them to ensure that every Wisconsinite can take part in our democracy. And we believe that Wisconsin deserves a government of, by, and for the people, not the corporate elites. Corporations have no constitutional rights. They may not buy our elections. They may not buy our government. That doesn't sound like a narrow focus on collective bargaining to me. And those are the collective demands of the Wisconsin wave. I think it's important to recognize that on that day, I believe it was the 11th of February, when the governor unloaded this attack on public sector unions, and Sarah and I both teach at our community college in Madison, at Madison College. We are proud members of the American Federation of Teachers. That there was already a movement that was afoot. These principles had already been agreed to by over 100 labor, farm, community, student leaders around the state of Wisconsin, and we were already preparing. So I want to, first of all, encourage those of you from outside of the state of Wisconsin to take a look at the website at wisconsinwave.org, where we're working to build this popular movement, to recognize that organized labor is the backbone of any popular movement, but that what really is happening in Wisconsin is truly a popular movement, whether the media or whether some folks in leadership recognize it as such or not. The reality is that young people in particular, people who are not yet members of unions, who hope to be members of unions someday, they have been at the forefront of this movement from day one, whether they were 12 years old in middle schools or high school students or folks at the community and community colleges and public universities. This is a movement that's much broader than public, than organized labor. In terms of the future of this movement, I think that we need to recognize that that direct action that Monica was talking about, it's happening. It's happening all over the state. It's happening in Milwaukee, where there have been occupations that the Milwaukee Graduate Assistance Association, two of the representatives are sitting here in the audience. Please give them a hand. That they organized. Some of us come out of the TAA, but we want to recognize our sisters and brothers from Milwaukee. There have been sit-ins in high schools of towns like Richland Center, which until 20 years ago, when I was a kid, was a dry county. Right? And there are spontaneous sit-ins happening all over the state of Wisconsin. So what we're doing is we're embracing that, we're stepping it up. There are direct action trainings happening all over the state of Wisconsin. And what we're doing is we're going after the centers of power in the state of Wisconsin. Many of you know about the Koch brothers. You heard about Ian Murphy's call to the governor in which he posed as David Koch. But the reality is if the Koch brothers were to go away tomorrow, we'd still have this problem in the state of Wisconsin. And locally, for Wisconsinites, we have the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. We have the Bradley Foundation, based in Milwaukee, nearly billion-dollar endowment that's been funding this movement, and we're going after them. They've made life uncomfortable for us. We are making life uncomfortable for them. So that's what's coming in the state of Wisconsin. As Sarah mentioned, we have a statewide Wisconsin People's Assembly that's scheduled for April 10th. And so be looking for that. And we're building that. It'll be based at the downtown campus of Madison Area Technical College, or Madison College, as we're now branding ourselves, and the Orpheum Theater. And we expect that that will provide us with new opportunities to build this popular movement and to build horizontal connections between people who are at the rank-and-file level, mid-level leadership, not just the folks at the top. So that's something we're doing as well. What I want to just answer in my remaining time is the question of why Wisconsin. And I think you've started to get a little bit of a sense of that. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull out a flag that used to fly on top of the state capitol. And unless anybody think that maybe we stole this, I will say this was a birthday present from Sarah that was provided by that state representative, Mark Pocan. And if you look at our state flag, it's kind of a normal flag, but there is this word on the flag, and that is forward. Okay. And it should appear right here below. Right there. Forward, right above a minor and the seaman. We used to be a state that had more of a seafaring culture. Maybe John will hold it up there. Excellent.
I don't want our flag to ever be soiled.
Well, there we go. So people in Wisconsin know that forward represents the progressive tradition. What most of us don't realize is that that slogan originally came from the revolutions of 1848. Forward to a workers' republic. Forward to a workers' republic. The state of Wisconsin came into statehood, and it was an alliance between Yankee revolutionaries, hardcore abolitionists. We almost seceded over slavery on the other side in the 1850s, and refugees from the revolutions of 1848 who came to Wisconsin. They built the alliance. The state's identity is intertwined with the progressive movement. And so I think what happened immediately when the governor went after the backbone of the progressive movement, organized labor in the public sector, was that people felt that an injury to one was an injury to all, because we have a very strong identity as Wisconsinites. Everything that we know as people who are born, in some cases, and raised, in my case, in the state of Wisconsin, is tied with the idea that we are a progressive heritage state. So you saw many people who may not belong to unions, who may not have members of their immediate family who are union members, but who saw the attacks on public sector unions, the attacks on Badger Care, the attacks on the University of Wisconsin system, whether they went there or not, as an attack on them personally, on their identity as Wisconsinites. Okay? And I can tell you it feels good to us as Wisconsinites to see all of y'all, and I'm borrowing from the South there a little bit. That is not an expression we use in Wisconsin. But to see all of you, fly in our state, outline in our flag. So thank you for doing that. It's important to just recognize that that's a very unique feature in the state of Wisconsin. Now, what can you learn from it? Well, every state, every place has a history of struggle. And the more that you build that history of struggle into your movements so that people have a sense of place that is tied to what they are doing, so that an attack on public sector unions here in Wisconsin, when it's coming from Governor Cuomo, right, is an attack on New Yorkers, right? The better off you will be in building a broader movement. And that's just, I would advise you to do that. Secondly, in Wisconsin, we have strong institutions in many different sectors of the progressive movement, in the farm sector, among students, in community organizations, all across the state, and with the tribal communities, primarily in northern Wisconsin. Strong institutions, and there's a lot of intersectionality, I'll use a sociological term there, intersectionality between these different movements, to the point at which people really do know each other. They knew each other on February 11th. They knew each other on February 14th. And it was possible to, again, develop this sense of solidarity and motion, this mobilization, very quickly. Third, recognize that Wisconsin has actually been a leader in the fight against corporate power for my entire life. In the 1990s, Exxon came into northern Wisconsin. They wanted to open the largest metallic sulfide mine in the world. In northern Wisconsin, we went up against what at the time was the largest corporation in the world, and we beat them. We had to beat them. And in fact, a governor who was funded by Exxon and whose top aide was an Exxon lobbyist signed into law a bill effectively banning metallic sulfide mining in the state of Wisconsin. We have, as was mentioned, moved to amend on April 5th. We have elections in Wisconsin. In Dane County and in Madison, there will be resolutions on the ballot, which voters will be voting on, calling for constitutional amendments to overturn Citizens United by making clear that money is not speech and corporations are not persons, right? Why is it significant? Yeah, that's great. And it will pass. I will tell you, it will pass. Why is it significant? And I can give you many other examples. The student anti-sweatshop movement in the United States started at UW-Madison. That's where Sarah and myself, where we met 15 years ago, right? It started at UW-Madison. There are many movements that have been based in Wisconsin. Why is that significant to our victories so far? Well, it was not difficult to convince Wisconsinites to get off of the defensive and to go on the offensive in the days following February 11th. We already knew who the enemy was. We've been fighting them all along. And we've been going after them hard. So I would advise you to take a page from somebody who grew up on the East Coast but became a famous Wisconsinite and recognize that the best defense is a good offense. And that is a lesson from the state of Wisconsin. Go on the offensive. Go after corporate power. Go after capital. Divide capital. That's something that's happening right now in Wisconsin. Finally, what should others do? I've been giving you some unsolicited advice. John gave you some of this advice. Others have as well. I mentioned earlier that anti-mining fight, and I was reminded of that anti-mining fight earlier today because I've been a little bit under the weather. There's been a bug going around. Everybody who's been at the state capitol has been running a fever, frankly. They call it the capital flu. And it's been a little bit wearying, but it reminded me of another kind of contagion. The mining industry called the anti-mining movement in Wisconsin the Wisconsin contagion. They told Exxon, they said, you have to stop. You have to go away. Because this movement is spreading from Wisconsin's North Woods to the UP of Michigan, to Ontario. And you're going to threaten all of our interests in this vital mining region. They said it was a Wisconsin contagion. And in order to stop it, they pulled away. Well, I hope you catch the Wisconsin contagion. I heard you. This is one bug you want to catch. Spread this movement. Take it to Cuomo. Take it to Jerry Brown. Take it to your governors. Organize and have the courage to believe that what you did not believe was possible is possible and, in fact, is necessary. So thank you for listening to us, and I look forward to the conversation once Elizabeth Wrigley Field has shared her remarks.
Great. Thank you, Ben. Our next speaker is Elizabeth Wrigley Field. I think we've been seeing photos of Elizabeth. I think that photo, speaks volumes for her bio. But she's a graduate student at University of Wisconsin at Madison and an active member of the Teaching Assistant Association, the International Socialist Organization, and Wisconsin Resists, which is a new grassroots coalition opposing Walker's agenda for Wisconsin. Elizabeth's recent activities include occupying the state capitol, organizing against the privatization of the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and organizing support for workplace actions against Walker. Elizabeth Wrigley Field.
Hi. The thing that's been hardest for me to convey to people who haven't been in Wisconsin is how palpable the sense of unity and solidarity is. Being in Madison, it feels like it's the people against the governor and the Koch brothers, frankly. Austin talked about, all over town, cars drive around honking, this is what democracy looks like on their horns. I was in a restaurant where someone yelled, show me what democracy looks like, and everyone in the restaurant put down their forks and stood up and started chanting. Everyone has stories like that because that's what it's like. Last week I had to go to the doctor. Ben pointed out everyone who's occupied the Capitol has what I affectionately call Capitol plague. And the first question at my doctor's visit was, didn't you get dragged out of the Capitol by the police? And after they finished thanking me, all of the nurses wanted to talk to me, and they wanted to talk about the fear that they have that they won't be able to afford to stay nurses if Walker's cuts go through. And they also wanted to talk about how they've been going on their lunch breaks to protest down at the Capitol or withdrawing their money from M&I Bank or whatever they can figure out to do. And mostly they wanted to talk about what everyone wants to talk about, which is, now what? Living in Madison right now feels like you're having one uninterrupted conversation that you just pick up and leave off with different groups of strangers as you go about your day, on the bus, at school, at coffee shops, in the grocery store, and there's always the same two themes to the conversation, and they are, how evil is our governor, and how are we going to stop him? When Walker started ramming his bill through late last week, the phrase on everybody's lips was general strike. When I got into the state capitol, there were already thousands of people chanting that. And I think what everyone was hoping that day is that the teachers would go out first and then everybody would just kind of follow them like dominoes. And actually, I believe that that day, the day that the assembly voted the budget repair bill through, if the teachers, or for that matter, if anyone had called for sick outs, I think many, many workers from many different sectors would have followed. But that's not actually what happened. And there's a reason why it didn't happen, and it's that the unanimous strategy from the state Democratic Party and the upper echelons of the labor movement in Wisconsin is to focus everything on recalling the Republican senators in the hopes that eventually new Democratic majorities will be able to overturn the worst of Walker's attacks. Now, to be very clear, I believe that every single person who has aided and abetted Walker's agenda for Wisconsin deserves to be recalled. Yeah, and the fact that a bunch of them probably will be is a very good thing for Wisconsin. But there are also thousands of us in Wisconsin who know that that is not enough. And we know that the reason why we've gotten this far is because of the direct action of tens of thousands of people. Some of that was thousands of us occupying the Capitol for 16 straight days and nights, and then occupying it again when the bill went through. Some of it was also the direct action of teachers shutting down schools so that they and their students could join the protests instead. When we sat in at the State Assembly last week, 2 weeks ago, all the time blurs together, to try to stop the bill, we sat in at the State Assembly, and the state Democratic staffers and the NGO staffers came to beg us and command us to leave like the police had ordered, which is actually something that happened repeatedly during the Capitol occupation. And what they kept saying to us was, think about how this is going to look. You're not thinking about how it'll look.
You look great.
Right? Thank you. You know what I thought when they said that, and actually what I said when they said that, right, because we had organized democratic discussions in the Capitol about what do we want to do here, that debated and tried to organize that together in a more democratic way. What I said was, let's try to think back before this all began, just 1 month ago, and imagine the idea that teachers en masse were going to call in sick with no notice and shut down schools across the state. Imagine the most vilified occupation, leaving parents and children in the lurch. I mean, can you imagine anything that would look worse than that? I can't, but what actually happened? Individual teachers started calling in sick so they could go to the protests, and then so many did it that the teachers' union said, you know what, if you call in sick, we're going to protect you. And then so many more teachers did it that school had to shut down. In Madison, it shut down for 4 days, and it spread around the state. And when the teachers did that, I think it did two things for our movement. The first is that it changed the narrative about public sector workers in Wisconsin, because the teachers had to explain why did we call in sick, and that story started to get out. And because the students came, thousands of students from around the state flooded into Madison in support of their teachers. In Madison, thousands of students, high school students, went back to school on a Saturday just so they could walk out again. Right. So that was one thing it did, but I think the sick outs did one other thing as well, and that's that they showed to the whole state that this movement is a plausible force for standing up to Walker and his cronies and all of his cuts. And I think it was that moment in that very first week that this became not just a fight of public sector unions against Walker, but it became a fight of private sector workers, non-union workers, the unemployed, anybody who cares about democracy. That's when it became the people against the governor, because the teachers went on their sick out. Right now in Wisconsin, there are thousands of people who want to figure out how to take that kind of action again, but do it bigger, because we can see that Walker is not backing down. He's escalating, and we know we have to escalate our side as well to figure out how to stop him. There's no immediate venue for people who feel that way to try to express that feeling or organize it. That's something that's just beginning, right? So there's small coalitions forming. I think that we're in the early stages of that. Creating those spaces, right, democratic spaces where people can figure out what to do, where we can begin workplace organizing, which, by the way, I think is going to start very small, but is incredibly important to take the confidence of the Capitol protests and start to bring that back into work. But it's not going to be just workplace organizing either. You know, people don't necessarily know outside Wisconsin, in the midst of the Capitol occupation, disability activists did another occupation. They occupied the state GOP office, saying this is not just about collective bargaining, it's about health care in the state, and we're going to occupy it as well. So creating those spaces where those of us who know this is not just going to be a recall, it's going to be more than that, that's the urgent task in Wisconsin right now. And that task is just at the very beginning, but it is beginning. And what I want to say to conclude is, as this struggle from Wisconsin is spreading, right, it's spreading to Indiana, to Ohio, to Michigan. Michigan occupying the state capitol last week. I felt like I was watching footage from Wisconsin where they're chanting, "This is our house," right, which is our chant for our state capitol. You know, as this spreads around the Midwest, I think the question of American exceptionalism has finally been laid to rest. The American working class may have been the sleeping giant, but in the Midwest, finally, it is woken up. Thank you.
Okay, one of our questions is, do you think that it was a wise decision for the unions to agree to concessions? What should they have done if you disagree with that decision? Okay, to any of you.
Bad idea.
Yeah, I'll be clear, not all the unions did agree to concessions. And there's a dynamic here where we've talked a lot about the teachers. Madison Teachers, Inc., is a very strong union that was responsible for leading the charge in the sick-outs. But the leadership of that union is not necessarily at the table when decisions are made at the top, which is crazy, frankly, which is crazy. And so firefighters, the teachers, you know, certainly my local wasn't consulted. We didn't agree to concessions. And so that is, we have some issues, too. We can talk about some issues. There's a dynamic. It's not even so much the state-level labor leadership. It's the national labor leadership, the same dynamic you've seen in labor struggles my entire lifetime, where, you know, the kettle is boiling, and they want to keep a lid on it.
Just a little context on the, all the labor leaders, nearly all the big state unions and public employee unions in Wisconsin said, we'll agree to the 12% health insurance co-pays, we'll agree to increase our pension contributions, as long as you don't take away our collective bargaining rights. And the strategy here, which I think was probably wrong, but the strategy was, I'll defend it now, was to say, this is not about the budget, this is not about this phony crisis that Scott Walker's using to justify this attacks, these are actually about fundamental rights that Wisconsin workers hold. And so we've already agreed to all the concessions, therefore the only issue left on the table really is whether we're going to have the right to bargain. And what ended up happening is because of the 14 Democrats fleeing to Illinois, they couldn't get a quorum on the fiscal bill, which is the budget, so they just passed collective bargaining as a standalone measure. So Scott Walker was no longer able to say, this was essential for me to balance the state budget. It actually just passed as a standalone bill. And so I do think that because of the 14 Democrats and because of the strategy of the unions, it ended up crystallizing the issue a lot more clearly about workers' rights and less about the budget, which confuses people because people don't understand numbers and it just sounds like a lot of billions of dollars. So that's my weak sauce defense of the early concessions.
I want to speak to this also because I actually think that the contracts being signed, I mean, let me just say, I think they are terrible contracts, right? So that the contracts that many teachers have just signed say that the district can renegotiate just reassign teachers' health care contributions without bargaining with the union at all. And I think there's a reason for this, and it's that the union apparatus is more concerned with maintaining the union apparatus as it's, you know, maintaining the dues checkoff and everything else, and that's what was maintained in the teachers' contracts. I think what was lost in the concessions is the chance to say, actually, it's a lie that public sector workers are the reason why there is a deficit. That's not true at all. It's because two-thirds of corporations in the state of Wisconsin pay no taxes to the state of Wisconsin that there is a deficit in Wisconsin. And that's what I think the unions should have been saying, and that's how I think we have the basis for solidarity between the different fights, is saying it's not just about collective bargaining. It's about the tax on the working class and the poor of Wisconsin.
And just to be clear, the budget repair bill was not just about collective bargaining. Badger care, food share. So by doing that, frankly, some of those folks who made that decision, they left high and dry the people who had been coming out and supporting them.
So we actually have a question specifically about the budget. That on January 31st, the Wisconsin Legislative Fiscal Bureau released a report stating that there was a budget surplus. Can you briefly describe the timeline of the creation of the deficit, for example, the tax cuts, and detail where the $3.6 billion deficit Walker claims comes from?
During the campaign, Walker went around the state and promised big business about $1 billion in handouts from the state of Wisconsin. And so he had to come up with a way to take money out of one pot and hand it over to them. The state of Wisconsin was about to pretty much break even if there was no new spending and maybe even have a little bit of a surplus. So what he did as soon as he got into office was passed a bunch of tax cuts for the wealthy, and also did what he called a tort reform, and through various means created a little bit of a deficit, about $170 million. And the Department of Administration, when they issued what they said was this huge budget crisis, they built into their assumptions 6% spending increases, right, which weren't going to happen, in addition to assuming that the contracts for state employees would actually get better than they were right now, like the state would cover 100% of health care and pensions, which wasn't going to happen either. So our Legislative Fiscal Bureau, basically the nonpartisan group that figured it out, basically said, you know, this is totally fiction, made up fairy tale, and of course because we have no real media in the state of Wisconsin that actually should be reporting the truth, they've just taken Walker's assumptions and numbers and just, you know, regurgitated them out to the public and, you know, perpetuated this fiction of a state budget.
Okay. So we had a question specifically around Monica's comments. One of the audience members had said that, you know, Monica had raised very critical and important concerns central to the notion of social change. And can other panelists address how issues of race have been or have not been part of the decision-making process in Wisconsin?
I think one thing is that the discussion we were just having about concessions is central to this, because if the unions are saying that after everyone who came out, you know, which is not just public sector workers, but it's been a broad slice of the state of Wisconsin, after all of that, then we're willing to give up everything to preserve collective bargaining and the union apparatus, then that is saying, you know, we don't care about the people who are going to lose their health care. We don't care about the early release program for prisoners being taken out of the state of Wisconsin, which is saying, you know, there is no such thing as recidivism. There is no such thing as rehabilitation in our state. I mean, that's one of Walker's bills as well. You know, we know who it's going to hurt to cut almost $900 million from public K-12 education in the state. And I feel like this is kind of a strategic crossroads for the labor movement, among other movements, to be not just a labor movement, but a social justice movement as well. But I think that there are currents within labor that feel very strongly that that discussion about race and about women's rights, that it has to be an integrated movement, but that doesn't yet have an expression in the labor institutions in Wisconsin. That's one of the things that I think is going to have to develop.
Yeah. So if you look at the principles of the Wisconsin Wave and who those initial signatories were, there was a very conscious effort leading up to February 11th to build a popular movement, to build the kind of solidarity and that would be required under some kind of austerity attack that we knew was coming, right? And I had meetings with the leadership of AFSCME, teachers' unions. There was only one state-level union I did not talk with, leading up to that time. But when the attack came down on collective bargaining, as John said earlier, I was at the offices of AFSCME for a coalition meeting that was strategizing around the state budget. And the faces were whiter than they normally are at AFSCME. People were in shock. And what happened was that those conversations stopped happening at the top level. Okay, and that essentially the types of strategic considerations that we've already discussed came into play, where they said this is a matter of survival. Like, we will be out of work, not just our members, not just Sarah and myself, we'll lose our homes, right? And Austin's family and many other people, right? But we will be out of work, and we have to put everything into this. So to their credit, they put everything into it, right? But to their discredit, they dropped the sense that this needed to be a broader popular movement. Now, we're starting to see signs of a broadening, I think, again, where there are various mobilizations that are happening in the state of Wisconsin. And, community of color leaders in Madison, for example, with Freedom Inc., where there was this march yesterday, are not waiting for permission, just like the farmers at Family Farm Defenders, who are also involved in the Wisconsin Wave, are not waiting for permission to organize, or just like we didn't wait for permission on March 5th. You all saw Michael Moore came and joined us at our rally. Well, guess what? We had 50,000 people there anyway. He gave a great speech. But that was the first mass rally that was organized that was not organized by labor leadership, right? That was organized by all kinds of folks, right? So they're responding to us now, and I think things are going to start to move in the coming weeks and months.
So we had a number of people who submitted questions regarding the idea of a general strike, and the questions are really varied. That, has the Democratic Party played a particular role in controlling that debate? Has the union leadership, what role have they played? Have they been more of a demoralizing force around a debate around a general strike? What are the real possibilities of it? Where is that discussion taking place?
I can speak to that, but just, I mean,
open to any of you.
So much.
It might be at this end a little bit and jump in, I think. Yeah.
Have the Democrats and the top labor leadership tried to keep out the idea of a general strike? Yes. I think that, what I said in my speech is true about the unanimity at that level of the idea that this is a recall fight and nothing but a recall fight. And the phrase that I've heard is, we don't want to let things get out of hand. That was what they said, kind of pulling the plug on the Capitol occupation, right? Like, this has gone far enough. The thing is that at the local level, many, many people think that there needs to be a general strike, including local labor leaders. But the question is more, there is no infrastructure for any of those people to try to make it happen. And so I think that where we're at now, people outside Wisconsin have been asking me, is there going to be a strike on this day or that day? And to be honest, everything changes really quickly, so all predictions should be not that definite. But I personally don't think that there's likely to be a strike of any kind in the immediate. I think that the extent to which labor has sort of said we're not going to do that is very extreme. But I think there is a kind of new sorting out process taking place where people are starting to take the struggle back into the workplace and that, the potential to do that is so much greater now than it has been for a very long time because of the last month. That's where I think the kind of new momentum around striking is going to come from. But I think it's not going to be as fast as maybe we thought 2 weeks ago.
Actually, Ben, if I could just interject one more question into this. There are also a couple of people from the audience have submitted questions around, is this struggle capable of changing the idea of what unions stand for? One, and two, I know, like myself, we heard so much of the talking points that you would hear from a lot of the top leadership, not only in Wisconsin, but also from the national leadership, was very much about this is preserving the middle class, the middle class, the middle class. So the question would be, how can this movement really be translated into a broader movement for unionization, particularly for working class and working poor workers in Wisconsin? And has that also been part of the broader, the broadening out of the political message of the struggle?
So I think a number of us have responses. I'll just add to Elizabeth's earlier response. I think that it's important to recognize that the Democratic Party is divided in Wisconsin. They showed a lot of unity when we had tens of thousands of people in the state capitol building every day. But there are some Democrats who I think would support a general strike in the state of Wisconsin. I know some of them. They serve in the state legislature. They may not say so publicly, right? But they have a problem, which is that they have a party apparatus which is not friendly to the idea. And I'll just leave it at that, because I agree with pretty much everything Elizabeth said otherwise. In terms of the question of unionization, I don't know on that question. I don't know that you're seeing – I know there are conversations happening around building union density and new sectors of the economy in Wisconsin. But I think it's also important to recognize that this is not just about building the labor movement, right? This is about democracy. And one thing that was very encouraging was that you saw that language that recognized that the problem is power in the state of Wisconsin, everywhere, in the streets and in the Capitol and all over the state. So I don't even know if the answer is to build union density, to be frank, considering some of the things that I've experienced within the labor movement. But I do know that there is a democracy movement afoot in the state of Wisconsin, and that that we really need to be looking at how do we go after corporate power? How do we go after the lack of democracy in our state? And how we're going to advance democratic reforms?
I think, a couple things. I think, one, we need to be careful about aligning the mobilization here with any particular political party. I think it's dangerous to say that this mobilization is in support of Democrats because they have done things that have failed us. And once again, I'm going to center the experience of folks of color where these Democrats don't have a good track sheet with me. High five. And so to be clear about that, right? And in terms of the general strike, I think a general strike is a good idea, but the way I'm perceiving it right now is that it may indeed be your Trump here, and is this a good time to spend it? I don't know, because this is going to be a longer fight. So the question is, can you strike for 10 months until January, 8 months, whatever, my math, but until January, I don't know. So those are things that we have to figure out, and if and a strike can come later, but how do we get from here to a strike? I think we also need to spend some energy in terms of figuring out. Now, a couple comments about this being to save middle class. I'll be very clear, I'm not a part of this to save a middle class. You should not. There's nothing radical about saving the middle class. I'm just going to put that out there. I don't think that that's a leftist idea. But I think there's something to be said for preserving and increasing quality of life, and so I stand in solidarity with those principles. Now, in terms of what that means for unions and unionization of other things, I think it's a shame that I think it's a strength and also a shame, though, that the unions that have been represented are representing professionals. I mean, I think the university having a presence is important. I think teachers being involved is important. But where are the other folks who jobs won't even allow them to have a union? Or where are other jobs who don't, other workers who don't have professional or college degrees who may be a part of union? I think they're going to be critical. They're going to be instrumental to what happens here, specifically in a dairy state. It's more than just the people who came in on tractors. It is the undocumented workers. It is the migrant workers who don't have unions. that I think we have to think about. And I also think we have to think we have to also be critical about this race and class and sex and gender, sexual orientation, so many other conversations that happen within unions, because we're talking about unions as if they're this ideal place to get to, as if they don't have their own challenges in and of themselves. And I'm careful about saying the goal is for every worker to be a part of a movement, because I don't want to be part of something in which I got to go through the same kind of rigmarole with oppression. So I think first to think critically about all of those questions.
So we're almost running out of time. I just want to read a message, though, that was handed out. Yeah, so this was a message that was handed in that said, please do not forget that in the U.S. colony of Puerto Rico, students shut down all campuses of the University of Puerto Rico back in May 2010 and launched militant strikes throughout the island in fights for tuition against tuition increases and privatization efforts of a right-wing governor, which has already laid off tens of thousands of public sector workers. Their struggle has been virtually ignored by mainstream media. We ask that you all support and promote the struggle.